Good afternoon, everyone. The Joint Legislative Auditing Committee will now come to order. Connie, please call the roll.
Representative Zika.
Present.
Senator Baxley.
Here.
Representative Barnaby.
Here.
Senator Boyd.
Here.
Senator Bradley and Senator Cruz have been excused. Representative Davis.
Here.
Representative Escamane.
Here.
Representative Persons Malika. Senator Torres.
Here.
Representative Trunow.
Here.
Quorum present.
Thank you. We have a number of items on the agenda, but we should be able to move through the first several items fairly quickly so that we'll have plenty of time for the audit presentations. The request from Representative Schoaf for an audit of the town of Greenville will not be considered at his request. Behind tab 2 is the committee's enforcement against local governments that have failed to submit required financial reports. I will call on Debbie to explain. Debbie, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Florida law requires local governmental entities, counties, municipalities, special districts to file a financial audit report with the Auditor General if audit thresholds set in law based on total revenue, total expenditures are met. And for each local governmental entity, an annual financial report, an AFR, with the Department of Financial Services. This is an electronic report using the audited numbers or their numbers that go into the local government online reporting system of DFS and can be viewed by the public. DFS and the Auditor General are required to notify the committee of the local government entities that have failed to submit the required reports. Possible state action for the committee to consider for municipalities is to withhold funds not pledged for bond debt service satisfaction. DOR has determined that that is half-cent sales tax money and municipal revenue sharing beyond the guarantee. The half-cent sales tax money is, once it's withheld, reverts to the state of Florida's general fund by statute. And we state that in our pre-meeting letters to the entities to let them know. For special districts, and then DFS will stop any like grant payments, reimbursement payments that would then be revouchered once the entity comes into compliance. The special districts, it's court action by DEO. The Special District Accountability Program is located within the Department of Economic Opportunity, and the court action is petition of enforcement in Leon County Court or proceed with inactive status declaration. They only go that route if they don't have registered agent or address information in order to serve somebody in court. Behind tab 2, there are various materials that we have. Shows the required notifications. We were notified of a total of 179 entities. We sent out approximately 150 certified letters in late September. Some of these entities had been dissolved or didn't have registered agent audit information. That's address information. That's why there's a difference between those two numbers. Lists 1 through 4 that are behind the tab show list 1 is the municipalities. List 2 is special districts, the independent special districts. List 3 is the dependent special districts. And list 4, there's 2 entities where there's recommended continue to delay action. It's the Campbellton-Graceville Hospital District that's supposed to be winding down, and then the Santa Rosa Bay Bridge Authority, which the governor has tasked DOT to negotiate with the bondholders and try to work something out with them. The recommended dates, the last column of each of those lists, we have a December 6th recommended date for entities that failed to respond to us or failed to respond to the Department of Economic Opportunity certified letter that they're required to send by law, which they then pass on to us. And then there's various other dates throughout based on the entity's status. Several examples include there's 2 municipalities where based on committee action in the past, they still owe the 18-19 audits and AFRs, the Village of El Portel in Miami-Dade County and the City of Gretna in Gadsden County. To date, El Portel has lost approximately $75,000 of half-cent money. They have not been in correspondence with us on letters, emails, everything. One time, I'm sorry, I failed to put in the history. The chairs did delay action back in June to allow a couple of months. We got an email from an interim CFO, and he's not responding anymore. So El Patel did not respond to anything we had on the fiscal year 1920 request for the status of the 1819 or the 1920. With the delay, they DOR released about 27,000 in municipal revenue sharing, and they are currently sitting on about 7,000, which on the municipal revenue sharing, they DOR will return that if they become in compliance within the state fiscal year. So if they get into compliance by June 30 of 2022, they'll get this money. Gretna had received less half cent, 41,000, and they lost at the cusp of June 30 of this year. They lost 35,000 for the former state fiscal year, and there's and DOR sitting on about 60 something thousand in municipal revenue sharing. We did hear from them. There is information behind their tab. There's an extra recommendation for Gretna. They have asked. They've got two state grants, one with Department of Economic Opportunity, Community Development Block Grant, and DOT, where they're asking if the committee would allow the release of that money to specified money on contractor invoices where the contractor has already completed payment. So there's a recommendation to allow staff to contact, and then DOT. There's a one for DOT. And then if those amounts match up with what the agencies are telling us, to then to tell DFS to release that specific money that then goes to pay those contractors, just to hold the contractor harmless, even though the city's in noncompliance with another state law. Also, the biggest one we're missing is the Consolidated City of Jacksonville. They have been in contact with us since June on where they stand. They started a accounting system conversion right before COVID hit, and then everybody's working remotely. You know, they encompass Duval County, the City of Jacksonville, the Port Authority, the Transportation Authority, all the CRAs. I mean, just public library, just there's a massive. And they are, their work auditors have been working with them side by side. They expect to get those all those reports in before the end of this month. But they have been very good and proactive in talking to us on where they are. And staff is in agreement that you don't want to rush that process. They want to make sure everything is right going forward because it could impact, you know, years to come. There are a few on list three where there is no recommended action against the dependent special district because the primary government, their municipality, is required by statute to file that AFR as part of their AFR to DFS. So the action would be against the city. And I'll be happy to answer any specific questions if anybody's got.
Thank you, Debbie. Are there any questions before we consider a motion? Questions. I will call on Vice Chair Baxley for the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee accept staff recommendations for the municipalities and special districts on list 1 through 4 and direct staff to contact the Department of Revenue and the Department of Financial Services or the Department of Economic Opportunity as appropriate and direct them to proceed according to the provisions of Section 11.40(2) Florida statutes. Staff shall notify all parties required to be notified by law regarding these entities. I further move that the chair, with the consent of the vice chair, be permitted to delay action against the entities on list 1 through 3 if additional information is brought to their attention that should be considered in determining the effective date of the committee's action. Staff shall deliver a copy of any such decision to the members of this committee, President of the Senate, and the Speaker of the House, and staff shall continue to monitor the special districts on list 4. That is my motion.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Are there any questions? See no questions, any debate? Okay, see no debate. Connie, please call the roll.
Representative Barnaby.
Yes.
Senator Boyd.
Yes.
Representative Davis. Representative Escamani.
Yes.
Representative Persons-Maluka.
Yes.
Senator Torres.
Yes.
Representative Trunau. Senator Baxley.
Yes.
Representative Zika.
Yes.
Motion passed.
The motion is adopted. Thank you. Tab 3 is our enforcement against local governmental and educational entities that have failed to correct audit findings that have been repeated in three or more audit reports. Debbie will present. Debbie, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Florida law requires the Auditor General to notify the committee of the repeat audit findings. Behind there's separate tabs behind tab 3, so it separates the educational entities from the local governmental entities. And in it, behind main tab 3, there's a directory of the schedule of the entities in alphabetical order if you're interested in any particular entity. There's also some schedules that contain a green background. Those are findings where the CPA is required by standard auditing standards to put those in, separation of duties, small entities, the CPA helping prepare the financial statements. So the recommendation in those cases is not to request a written response. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Debbie. Any questions for Debbie? Okay, see none. I will accept a motion to accept the staff's recommendations and also direct staff to send a letter to any entity for which the Auditor General reports uncorrected audit findings to the committee for late filed 2019-2020 audit reports unless a response has been previously provided and it appears that the entity has taken corrective action to the extent possible using existing resources.
So moved.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Are there any questions? Any debate? Okay, I see none. All in favor of adoption of the motion, say yay.
Yay.
Opposed, say nay. Okay, the motion is adopted. Thank you. For our next item, Kathy will present the results of the audits of the lobbying firm compensation report and explain the revisions to the guidelines that we will vote on. Kathy, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Legislative and executive branch lobbying firms are required to file quarterly compensation reports with the legislature's lobbyist registration office and to report the amount they have received from each principal or client and the total they receive from all principals. An audit of the filed compensation reports is required to be conducted by independent certified public accountants. This committee facilitates the audits, and previously as required, the committee developed guidelines to conduct the audits, develop procedures for the selection of auditors, and develop a system to randomly select audit firms for an audit. This was the seventh year of the audits. There have now been 178 audits completed on 159 unique firms. Last February, we conducted, with the assistance of the Auditor General, a random selection of 3% of the lobbying firms for an audit of their 2020 compensation reports. This resulted in a total of 23 audits, 11 executive branch, and 12 for the legislative branch. We had four audit firms under contract to perform this year's engagements. Behind tab 4, you'll find summary information about the audits. The statute refers to audit, but in the accounting world, they are actually agreed upon procedures, a type of attestation agreement, engagement. Lobbying firms were randomly selected for either an audit of their 2020 executive branch compensation or their legislative branch, not both. If an audit, firm was selected, it's for one branch, the compensation for the other branch was not within the scope of the audit. Lobbying firms report their compensation in broad ranges. The amounts for each principal is in about a $10,000 increment, unless it's $50,000 or more, and then it's rounded to the nearest thousand. The total compensation from all principals is in a much larger, broader range of about $50,000 range for the low end, but it goes up as the amount goes higher. Of the 23 audits, findings were reported for 10 lobbying firms. 8 of the firms overstated compensation for one or more quarters and for one or more principals. 4 understated or did not report compensation. 4 of the lobbying firms both overstated and understated compensation. All of the lobbying firms have now amended their compensation reports to address any over or under reporting. There were also a few other non-compensation related findings, such as a lobbyist failed to list a prime contractor firm. There was some documentation lacking for certain transactions. And at times, either a lobbyist or principal was listed on a compensation report, but there was not a corresponding registration or authorization. The amount paid to the audit firms for the 23 engagements was just over $115,000, and the range from a low of about $1,300 to about $18,000. The funds paid are not taxpayer funds. They are fees that are primarily driven by the annual registration fees that the lobbyists pay. With leadership approval in February, we'll begin the next cycle of audits by selecting the lobbying firms for an audit of their 2021 compensation. Also in your packet are draft revised guidelines for your consideration. The guidelines include the procedures that the audit firms must follow when they perform the engagements. The primary reason for the revision is that an update to professional audit and attestation standards went into effect this past summer that made some of our information obsolete, specifically appendices A through C. And the audit firms must follow these standards. There are also a couple of technical and clarifying changes. Also, we added a checklist for the audit firms as an appendix to help them comply with our contract requirements. And we added one new procedure. Audit firms will report a finding if a lobbying firm receives compensation for lobbying from a third party that is not a principal or a prime contractor. This is a requirement. This is something that's in statute. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Kathy. I will accept a motion to approve the draft guidelines and allow staff to make technical and clarifying changes.
Move to approve.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Are there any questions? Representative Escamani, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Chair. I just have a very quick question. For those that understated or overstated, they correct it. If they choose not to correct or contest the findings, what happens then? It's more of an operational question.
Kathy, you're recognized.
Once they have a finding, that won't go away. For transparency, they have an opportunity to change it, and we ask the auditors to specify that. But there is, on the executive branch situation, the Commission on Ethics is required to initiate an investigation, and they have their process. If there's probable cause, that's provided, sent to the governor and cabinet. They've not worked all the way through the process. On the legislative side, I know some staff look at the reports, but nothing has really gone further.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I see no other questions. Any debate? Okay, no debate. All in favor of adoption of the motion say yay.
Yay.
Opposed say nay. Okay, see, the motion is adopted. Thank you. Next is the Transparency Florida report the committee is required to provide to the governor, the president, and the speaker. At our last meeting, staff of the governor's office and DFS demonstrated the transparency websites so that they manage, and staff provided a summary of the draft report. Representative Persons-Malitzka submitted a recommendation that we will consider including in our report. You will find her recommendation behind tab 5. Representative Persons-Malitzka, you are recognized to explain your recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for considering this recommendation today. I spoke briefly about this issue at our last meeting, and I'll just give a brief overview once again. The governor, via Executive Order Number 20-44 that he issued in February of 2020, requires that for the following two type of entities, entities named in statute with which an agency must form a sole source public-private agreement with, and entities that through contract or other agreement with the state annually receive 50% or more of their income, of their budget, from either state-appropriated, state, or federal funds. And the executive order requires that each executive agency shall henceforth require from those entities, those two categories of entities, an annual report, including the most recent IRS Form 990, detailing the total compensation for the entity's executive leadership teams. In addition, the contracted entities must agree through appropriate contract or grant agreement amendment to inform the agency of any changes in total executive compensation between those annual reports. All compensation reports must indicate what percentage of compensation comes directly from the state or federal allocations to the contracted entity. I've observed that entities have started amending their contracts with those entities that are in grant agreements with the state to require submittal of those annual compensation reports. Agencies are starting to collect those executive compensation annual reports. They're subject to public records. However, they're not currently available on any of the transparency websites. So my recommendation would be to include those materials submitted to each agency in response to the executive order on either the Florida Accountability Contract Tracking System, the FACS website that includes all the contracts and contracts amendments, or other appropriate state transparency website. And thank you, members, for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions? Okay, I see no questions. Any debate? Okay. All in favor of adoption of the motion say yay.
Yay.
Okay. Opposed, say nay. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions about the draft report before we consider a motion to approve it? Questions. I will accept a motion to approve the draft report and allow staff to make technical and clarifying changes.
Move to approve.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Are there any questions? Okay, see no questions. Any debate? Okay, see no debate. All in favor of adoption of the motion say yay.
Yay.
Okay. Opposed? Nay. The motion is adopted. Okay. Next item, behind tab 6 is the Auditor General's operational audit of NICA, the Florida Birth-Related Neurological Injury Compensation Association. The audit was required in legislation we passed during the last session. The legislation also made changes to the program after troubling reports about the program's management came to our attention. Would like to invite Joshua Barrett, an audit manager with the Auditor General's office, will give the presentation. Mr. Barrett, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Appreciate the time to being able to present our audit findings related to NICA. As you mentioned, my name is Josh Barrett, and I was responsible for the audit. Just provide a little bit of background. Section 766.303 of Florida statutes established NICA and provided injury claims for any births occurring after January 1, 1989. And effective June 21st, 2021, chapters 2021-134 laws of Florida provided for the plan to be governed by a 7-member board. And also chapters 2021-134 laws of Florida provided that the Auditor General conduct an operational audit of NICA that focused on the administration of the plan, including compliance with section 766.303 through 766.315 Florida statutes and applicable public records and meeting laws. On August 13, 2021, the Auditor General issued operational audit report number 2022-009 with 7 findings in the areas of plan administration, assessments, selected administrative activities, and information technology controls. And I'll briefly go over those findings now. Our first finding dealt with the fact that NICA had not established a mechanism to effectively and consistently document, account for, and track benefit denials or disputes. Specifically noted that NICA had created the Claims Accounting and Reserves Electronic System, or CARES, to track participant activities such as administrative law judge orders, participant contact information, and claims for reimbursement. Our procedures found that while they had established procedures for benefit denials and disputes, they had not established a mechanism within CARES to effectively and consistently document, account for, and track benefit denials and disputes from the initial claims request to resolution. Our second finding dealt with survey results, and to measure the degree of plan participant satisfaction, in May 2021, we surveyed 279 individuals listed as contacts for the 221 participants active in the plan as of April 30th, 2021. Our survey questions addressed participant satisfaction with the handbook, explanation of benefits, NICA's handling of questions, and the dispute resolution process. And as shown on this slide, we received responses from 120 respondents, and the responses summarized in this table indicated that most of the respondents received the handbook and were satisfied with NICA's responses to participant questions. However, 41% of the respondents expressed dissatisfaction with the explanation of benefits and participant rights provided in the handbook, and 42% expressed dissatisfaction with the adequacy of NICA's explanation for the decision to approve or deny participant exemption request. Our third finding showed that NICA did not always include the rationale for denying or limiting participant claims reimbursements. Specifically, we noted that effective March 20th, 2020, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, issued an alert expanding the use of telemedicine during the COVID-19 pandemic for Florida Medicaid, and NICA had received copies of the ACA alert on March 24th, 2020. However, our examination of activity logs and participant records found that on March 24th and March 26th, NICA denied two participant requests for reimbursement of physical therapy telehealth services. In both instances, NICA records did not evidence that the expenses were not medically necessary and reasonable, or that NICA had requested from the participants letters of medical necessity from the telehealth services. On November 18th, 2020, NICA management had informed case managers that NICA was going to cover physical and occupational therapy telehealth services. NICA management also indicated that they were not aware of any out-of-pocket expenses incurred by participants for these services. We also noted that NICA records did not evidence the rationale for limiting a reimbursement request for computer uses augmented technology to $1,000 instead of the total $1,314 cost incurred. According to NICA management, NICA reimbursement for the claims was using guidelines included in a draft version of the handbook that detailed the limitations for computers without an adaptive program or attachment. Our fourth finding indicated that NICA did not timely or consistently use all available remedies to collect delinquent assessments from non-participating physicians. And as of June 16, 2021, active non-participating physicians owed NICA $14,367,193 for assessment amounts due for the 2016 through 2021 assessment years. And as shown in the table, these delinquent assessments represented approximately 13% of the total assessments during the 2016 through 2021 assessment years. Our fifth finding showed that NICA expenses associated with holiday luncheons for NICA personnel did not appear to be clearly necessary to the performance of NICA statutory duties. Additionally, we noted that meals provided for NICA personnel and board members were not limited to amounts provided in state law. Our sixth finding noted that NICA controls did not promote the retention of text and instant messages in accordance with state and public record laws. And specifically, we noted that NICA had not disabled text messaging nor established a method to capture and retain text messages sent or received by 19 NICA-owned mobile devices. And our examination of the mobile device invoices for the period July 4, 2019 through May 3, 2021 found that 1,101 text messages were sent or received by 16 of the NICA-owned mobile devices. Additionally, we noted that NICA had not disabled the instant message or iMessages on two NICA Apple devices, nor established a method to capture and retain messages sent or received by these devices. And our seventh finding noted that certain security controls related to user authentication for the network domain, NICA virtual private network, and the claims accounting and reserves electronic system need improvement to ensure the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of NICA data and information technology resources. And that is my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Are there any questions for Mr. Barrett before we ask the NICA representatives to come up? Representative Escamana, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. I was just curious, for the 120 respondents, can you remind us how many NICA families there are so we have an idea of how representative 120 is of a sample size?
You're recognized.
Yes, thank you for the question. During our time, we had a total of, there were 279 contacts and 221 participants that were active in the plan as of April 30th, 2021, which is when we sent the.
Thank you. Follow up.
One quick follow-up.
Absolutely. You're recognized.
Could you just define active for me? Are those folks who've, you know, are who've already received NICA, just a definition of active?
You're recognized.
Yes, those were individuals that were still enrolled in the program. The participants were still alive at that particular point in time.
Okay. You're recognized for a follow-up. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Today, here with us, we have the NICA board chair, Jim DeBogran, and the interim executive director, Melissa Jacks, available to answer any questions you may have. Chair DeBogran, I don't want to missay it, would you like to make some opening remarks?
Sure, I'll just be very brief. I wanted to mention we are a brand new board. I was appointed in August. The other four members were appointed after me. We have a brand new interim CEO. This report, as well as a report done by the Office of Insurance Regulation, the Insurance Consumer Advocate, Ms. Tasha Carter, all of these reports are painting kind of a common theme that there's a lot of improvement that can be made just largely in terms of internal processes and how we conduct business, and we're going to get there. It's not terribly complicated, but it's tedious. It's a lot of work, and it requires a concentrated effort over a period of time. But I do want to just on behalf of the board. Thank the legislature for the legislation. In particular, I fill the slot on the board that is the representative of an advocacy organization, and that's what you get with me as an advocate for people with special needs. And just my background, I have a family member with a developmental disability who also has some extreme medical complications, and I've worked with a number of advocacy organizations over the years, in a former life, I was the executive director of the state's agency for persons with disabilities. So that's my perspective. We also have a parent of a NICA child on our board. Those are two voices that previously were not present on the board, and I think that's really going to help us in terms of establishing credibility with the families we serve, and also making sure that we are putting these families and their interests first and foremost. And I would say that I really appreciate the fact that that legislation included underlined language, new language, that clarifies that our mission is to work on behalf of those families and on behalf of those children. Of course, with all the work to be done, we are a volunteer board. With all the work to be done, we need good staff and especially good leadership for that staff. And we lucked out Ms. Jocks. She had just gotten through with a temporary gig as the head of the domestic violence program and got that program on solid footing, and about the time that assignment ended, we were looking for an interim executive director. One of the first things I dealt with was the resignation of our previous CEO. So it was good luck because we got a good person and the timing was good. And if I could, I would like to defer any detailed questions to our CEO, Ms. Jocks. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Chair DeBogran, for your remarks, like to invite Ms. Jacks, and Jocks, sorry. and you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Melissa Jocks, interim executive director at NICA. I started a month ago yesterday. I have a long history of public service, primarily human services, state level, federal level, private nonprofit, and as Jim mentioned, most recently leading domestic violence services in Florida. And I do have to mention, 30 years ago, my first job out of college was working for the Auditor General, auditing the Florida Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services. I think that's where I first got my love of public service and my love of human services. I have met with staff. I've been communicating with our new parent board member, as Jim mentioned. This is the first time we've ever had a parent on our board. I've spoken to several families, and so I would like to share my priorities with you based on my observations, my 1 month worth of observations, and the concerns raised by you all last session. I have spent a lot of time on specific benefit requests from families. I think that you saw in the Auditor General report, and if any of you have seen the OIR report, that is the most significant issue we have. Arbitrary denials, no rationale for the denials, poor communication about why we're denying, unclear guidelines on what we will approve and what we won't approve. So that is where I have been spending most of my time. What I've learned, all we have to do is listen to these families. They are living their lives. We are not living their lives. They know what is best. They know what is, they know what is going to make their lives easier, and they know what their child needs. And as long as we listen, it makes our job much, much easier. As I mentioned, our benefit handbook is entirely too vague and does not contain clear information. I do want to say that beyond the benefit issues, NICA does struggle from something that a lot of small organizations struggle from. A lot of small organizations that have grown have long-standing employees. Things aren't written down. Policies and procedures aren't maintained. While that is a weakness, that is also a strength for NICA. Our staff are ready to embrace change. They are committed to our families. They are committed to our mission, and I'm so pleased to be working with them. So let me tell you some bullets of the things that I'm focused on. If you have questions on the specific findings, I'm happy to go over those, but I just wanted to present a high-level overview of the things that we're working on. As I mentioned, significant improvements to the benefit handbook, establishing a medical director or changing the focus of our existing medical advisory committee for decisions such as approval of experimental procedures and review of denied requests for reimbursement. Our current handbook states that approval of experimental procedures is to be made by the executive director. I'm not qualified to do that. We need someone with vast medical knowledge to assist us with some of those decisions. More formal documentation of the claims process, especially for denials. In the next 30 to 45 days, we'll be rolling out functionality in our client information system called CARES that will document denials, will provide explanation of benefits to families as well as denial letters. A family portal is a longer-term goal to best document the process from the time a family asks for reimbursement to the time that reimbursement is received or denied. We also need to document complaints. We don't currently document when a family files a complaint with us. The same functionality we're rolling out in the next 30 to 45 days will give us that ability. I am going to hire a parent advocate. You all might know that the legislation last year, some drafts contained an ombudsman. We're going to move forward with hiring a parent advocate to assist families in resolving issues. One of the charges that parent advocate will have is establishing a better and more frequent way for families to communicate with us. We have opened up the board meetings, and they do provide public testimony, but every 3 months for a short period of time is not the best way to get feedback from families. So we're looking for something looking like a parent advisory committee to get feedback from them on a frequent basis. We need to improve our orientation process with our families. As you can imagine, when they come into our program, they are in a very, very difficult position. They're at a difficult place in their lives. They have a lot of challenges, and we present them with a lot of information, which, of course, you can't retain. We need to do a better job of following up with them, making sure that they understand the benefits that are available to them, and helping them understand how to receive those benefits. As I mentioned, internal policies and procedures need improvement in their documentation, our claims manual, our procurement procedures. There was a criticism that we did not have written contracts for all third-party vendors. I assure you that will be fixed. Yesterday, we brought some temporary staff in to assist us with some functions, including getting our data off of CDs, which was one of the prior criticisms as well, into our client information system. Our plan of operations needs revision. And I've authorized two additional nurse case managers be hired because their workload is a little too high right now, and lower caseloads will help them provide better service to our families. As I mentioned, significant edits to our benefit handbook are needed. This is my highest priority. Some of the things that we need to include are clarity on whether a letter of medical necessity is required and from whom it is required. We have been inconsistent, and we have required it, in my opinion, too often. We have nurse case managers who are very familiar with these families. We don't need a letter of medical necessity for everything. Clarity on any monetary limits and the source of those limits, supported by rate schedules, which include effective dates. Transparency as to where decision making for the benefit approval resides. We need our case managers to be more empowered to make decisions, and families need to understand who is making those decisions. When and whether prior approval is required. Clarity on when NICA should be involved in ordering specialty equipment. We have relationships with many vendors. We can often get things for cheaper than the families can, so we need to provide clarity on what those relationships are. And clear time limits for reimbursement. We have many challenges ahead of us. The good news is it's clear what we need to do. It will take us some time, but we'll get there, and I'm honored to have been asked to step in. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Jax. Any questions for the director from the committee? Senator Boyd, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again. I don't have a question as much as a comment to my colleagues, if that's okay.
You're recognized, Senator.
We spent yesterday in insurance and banking in the Senate, we spent probably half of our meeting on the findings of not only OIR, but the Auditor General, ACA, and then Mr. DeBosier and Ms. Jax addressed us. And what we met prior to the meeting to go over some concerns. We all together last year, I think, did good work in passing the legislation we did. We recognize, certainly they recognize, there are many things that need to be fixed. And the Auditor General's report, as well as the OIR's report, illuminates those very well. What I took away from our previous meeting and then our meeting yesterday is Mr. DeBosier is certainly committed as the chair. Ms. Jax is known as a fixer, as Mr. DeBosier mentioned earlier. And I'm confident that, although there's a fair amount to fix, I think we'd all agree with that, that she's the right person for the job, and that we're heading in the right direction. So we're always certainly a resource and available for assistance, but we're confident in your ability, Ms. Jackson, Mr. Bogerin, for doing the right thing for the families that really need it most. And I know your commitment is there. And after yesterday's meeting, I was even more confident that that's the direction we're headed. So thank you, and thank you for that indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Torres, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jackson, welcome to the job. All I can say is, have you reached out to the families that were going through issues in the past?
Director Jackson, you're recognized.
Thank you. As reimbursement requests have come my way, and a lot of them are old because they're things that have been denied in the past, I have spoken to several families about them. I've called to say, hey, you know, what's this about? Can you give me some background? I have obviously not spoken to as many as I would like to, but I have reached out to several.
Please. Follow up.
Senator, you're recognized.
And also, I don't know if you're aware of, but Senator Book is drafting a new bill, Have you been over to see her, and any recommendations?
Director, actually, you're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, I met with her on Monday, and we reviewed the legislation, and there are some really good things in there for our families, and I look forward to continuing to work with her on that.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Representative Escamani, you're recognized.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. Just a few quick questions. Just referencing the handbook, you already mentioned that it could use a lot of improvements. I'm curious, you know, what are the efforts still to make sure multiple languages are made available with so many diverse communities? English is not always going to be the language that someone can understand concepts the best. Would be curious for your thoughts on how diverse is your staff to reflect directly impacted people in Florida, and what are the ability of translations to make sure all materials are available in multiple languages? And then obviously a handbook is one thing, but what's your thoughts on the person presenting the handbook, you know, their ability to also explain the content? We'd love some clarity on that.
You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for the question. We have diverse nurse case managers, but I'm going to be honest with you. I do not know what our policy is on publishing materials in multiple languages, so I will be following up on that. When we do finalize our new handbook, our nurses are going to need some training on how do we talk about it. You don't want to overwhelm people with information, but you want to get them the most pertinent information. The first step is getting the handbook done, and once we do that, we'll work through how best to work with families on that.
Thank you. If I have a quick follow-up.
Okay, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you so much. Thanks for that. And there are, you know, obviously translation can be internal, or you could do an RFP for vendors to help, but I think specifically I'm thinking about Spanish and Creole as the two main languages, but there could be other languages as well, and even interpretation line that could be offered to families. So just some things to think about when it comes to access and inclusivity. And then just real quick for finding one, that NICA has not established a mechanism to effectively and consistently document, account for, and track benefit denials or disputes. How do you track that? And just, you know, what are your thoughts on improving that process? I'm curious of just the baseline, but then what changes are you already making or plan to make?
You're recognized.
Well, baseline is bad. We were asked to provide all denials, and that just involved all of our nurse case managers going through their emails. So yes, the baseline is down here. So the functionality we're adding will address that issue. It will require the nurse case managers to put in when something is requested, and then when and if it is denied.
One quick follow-up, Chair.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you so much. Thanks for that insight, and I agree. That's a low place to start, but you can only go up from there, so that's positive. For your board, I know before shifts and changes happened, the board did not have that patient, the directly impacted person, rather, and it was mostly, my understanding was like insurance types of characters. What's the board makeup today? Are you still recruiting board members? How transparent is that process? Who leads your board recruitment efforts? Just some operational questions around that ecosystem.
You are recognized.
The CFO's office appoints the board. And I can tell you, so we have 5 members right now. We need 2 more. As Jim mentioned, he's the representative of the advocacy organization. We have a parent. We have a participating physician, a non-participating physician, and a representative of a hospital. And I apologize, I don't know what the other 2 are. I can look it up in statute real quick.
You can also follow up, too.
Okay,
that's not a big deal. Thank you.
Representative Barnaby, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to commend Mrs. Jacks for your commitment to providing transparency and certainly emphasizing this afternoon the importance of clarity. And you've certainly given me a lot of confidence in fact that you will do an excellent job in this agency, and I just wanted to thank you for being here and for your presentation this afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for the statement. Any other questions? Okay. Representative, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Just really quickly, Ms. Jacks, in your presentation, you talked a lot about some of the timelines would be 30 to 45 days, and my question to you is, that sounds great, but is that ambitious in retrospect of trying to correct the system that is, you know, somewhat broken at this point?
You're recognized.
The 34 to 45 days timeframe is the new functionality that we're rolling out in our system. You are correct. I can't get the rest of this done in 30 to 45 days. In fact, the benefits handbook, there was a draft presented to the board in late October, and the plan was that at the December board meeting, which is next week, that the final would be approved, and I've already notified the chair that there's no way for us to get that in the kind of shape it needs to be in for this board meeting, so it will have to wait till the March board meeting.
Follow up,
but it's
please,
more of a comment. Thank you, Chair. It's more of a comment than a question at this point. I had an earlier conversation with Ms. Jackson. I, like my colleagues, would like to commend you. At the beginning of that conversation, you talked about being a part of the interim and the domestic violence services here in Florida, and we know what kind of situation that was for the state and serving on that committee and listening to it. So again, thank you for stepping into another hot seat with this situation, but it seems like we have the right person in place to lead us out of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis, for the comment. Any other questions from the committee? Vice Chair Baxter, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to open these questions with your permission on just saying how grateful I am to join my colleague. Chairman Boyd has done a lot of work into this background. He knows the backstory, and I think we're all very excited about the message that help is on the way. This has been a difficult and thorny pathway, and I think, though, it has led to a much, much better future, and I have a lot of experience with Jim and his level of expertise and commitment, and he's done a lot of hard projects that I know about before and you, and I'm just delighted that we can tell this community of people who have very tough family lives that help is on the way. This was designed to do a couple of things. You know, one, quite frankly, was liability limitation in an area of very high liability, long-term cost, massive lawsuits, and simplify it, Ted, that there's a way to do this to help them deal with the challenge that's before them that no one would have wanted to happen, but that their lives are challenging and that we can partner with them. So I just thank you for embracing this. I think it still has tremendous capacity to be such a problem-solving entity rather than a place to come and argue and a place to come and say, how can we help you? Not, is there some reason we can't help you? The beginning point makes a big difference. And you know what it's like to be on the line when they're trying to see if there's some reason they can't help you versus somebody who's engaged and say, well, let's see how we can help you. That's a very different starting point. I think this is a good, rather than spending a lot of money on legal settlements and legal fees, having a process where there's a way to meet the needs of caring for a very special needs child in a very difficult situation, saying we're going to do this with you and not just give you liability to go that you can exercise going to court. This is a much better solution to walk with you. But I am curious, there's usually a lot of money there, and we've had a lot of questions about why is it still sitting there and people are underserved and unhappy. And I think you can resolve some of that quandary tremendously with this different approach that you're laying out as your management format. But what about that $14 million of uncollected dues, I would call it? I don't know what you categorize that income. That's a lot of money for a businessman to walk away from, and if you can recover that, that would give you such capacity. Do you have any comment on that, Arena?
You're recognized.
Thank you. And to be honest, I have not dug deeply into that issue. I have been focused on benefits. NICA's response was generally, I think the criticism that was that we weren't going after that quickly enough. And NICA's response is, instead of going off after each year, they bundle to save legal fees. And that's and it will go down over time. But it's on my list to spend a little bit more time on, and I apologize that I don't have a better response for you today.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Chairman. I would just say that's a wonderful answer, and I appreciate you giving me a little latitude on this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you. Any other questions? I do have one. The question I have is, earlier in the presentation, you highlighted some of the steps that you'd like to implement. If you are able to, are you able to tell this committee a time frame that all those steps will be completed by? Ballpark.
May I get back to you? I think I want to set a timeline for some of these things for myself. I haven't yet. I'm in the, here's the stuff that needs to be done. As I mentioned, benefit handbook number one, but I haven't sequenced the rest of it out yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Director. Thank you, Chair, for presenting in front of the Joint Legislative Auditing Committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, members, our last item today is a presentation of the Auditor General's operational audit of the Belle Glade Housing Authority. This audit was directed by our committee at the request of the Palm Beach County Legislative Delegation after it received reports of poor living conditions at the housing units. Greg Centers, Deputy Auditor General, will give the presentation. Mr. Centers, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity to provide this presentation on the Belle Glade Housing Authority operational audit. As the chair mentioned, my name is Greg Centers, Deputy Auditor General responsible for educational entity and local government audits. The Belle Glade Housing Authority is a special district, which is a local government down in Palm Beach County. The authority was created in 1947 to provide safe, sanitary, decent, affordable housing for low-income, retired, and disabled farm workers. The Housing Authority operates about 700 one-story homes to house one to two occupants. Your committee directed the Auditor General to conduct an operational audit, and our audit focused on the authority's performance in establishing and maintaining internal controls and other selected authority processes and administrative activities. A couple of months ago, we issued our report, and our report contained 9 audit findings. First finding, United States Department of Agriculture and the Florida Department of Health cited significant health and safety violations at the authority's migrant complexes because the authority did not properly maintain the complexes and did not promptly and effectively remedy those violations. Effective policies and procedures had not been established for identifying and responding to housing complex capital needs. The authority did not perform daily and annual housing inspections of record to ensure safe and satisfactory living conditions. The authority did not promptly and effectively record and track and resolve tenant complaints. Policies and procedures for accurately calculating tenant and applicant household income, prioritizing eligibility based on that income, and timely notifying applicants of their application status could be improved. Records did not always demonstrate that tenant eligibility was annually recertified or that certification notices were timely sent to all tenants. We also noted that standard tenant lease agreements and occupancy rules provided to tenants lacked some required disclosures. The authority paid $20,000 in a severance payment to a former maintenance supervisor. However, contrary to state law, the payment was not authorized pursuant to an existing employment contract. And then lastly, we noted that the authority had not established policies and procedures governing the use of tangible personal property. And that's a picture of the 9 findings that we had on our operational audit, and I'll entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Centers. Are there any questions for Mr. Centers before we ask the Housing Authority to come up? Representative Escamani, you are recognized.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thanks for this audit. Do we know how long the problems were persisting based on your audit? Was there a moment where the housing quality started to become degrading? Is there any timeline of when that happened, or has that been a persistent existence for these tenants until the recent shift?
Mr. Centers, you are recognized.
Thank you for the question. I know this has been an ongoing problem for a number of years. The USDA and the Florida Department of Health had cited these exceptions. And in the records we looked at, we saw correspondence back and forth from the USDA and the Housing Authority. Ultimately, the USDA personnel met with authority personnel and recommended that the authority's efforts were not sufficient, and that the authority had clearly demonstrated that it was unable to make the needed improvements, and strongly recommended that an independent third-party property management company be engaged, which they did, and they took over operations in January 2020.
Follow-up?
You're recognized, Rep.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. For finding 8, the $20,000 in severance pay, I'm curious, do we have a breakdown of all the salaries of those that manage this housing authority? And were there any other unusual bonuses or excessive salaries to make note of?
You're recognized.
They have roughly about 30 employees, or had, and in December 2019 is when they terminated all employees. And we looked at, there were only 2 severance payments. The first one to the executive director was pursuant to an existing contract, so it was legit, no problem there. The problem with the former maintenance supervisor was that they didn't have a severance payment provision in his contract. State law limits severance payments to 20 weeks of compensation. In this particular instance, he was paid 14 weeks of compensation, so it was within that window. It's just that it was not established pursuant to an existing contract.
And one more follow-up, Chair?
You're recognized.
Thank you so much. Shifting gears of the directly impacted people, could you provide clarity for the members of who are we talking about? Are these seniors, people with disabilities, families? Who are the folks who are living in these really horrific conditions at this housing authority?
You're recognized.
Yes, these tenants represented farm workers. They could be retired. They could be disabled. We didn't have a breakdown of the diversification of who actually lived there. We did know that some of the tenant agreements that we had concerns with, because they were in English, and a lot of the occupants were non-English speaking occupants.
Okay. Follow up? Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I see no other questions. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate
it. Thank you very much,
Mr. Centers. Representing the Belglade Housing Authority are Steve Weeks, the board chair, Ramona Heisen, president and CEO of Nelson & Associates, Gregory Heisen, vice president of Nelson & Associates. Chair Weeks, would you like to make some opening remarks?
Very quickly.
You're recognized.
In August of 2019, we realized that we had a serious problem. And through that time frame, working with USDA, working with other agencies, we hired the management company of Nelson Associates. We have got an ongoing, purpose-driven program designed to bring everything back up to grade, to making living conditions much better than they were, rehabbing all of our 714 different units over a period of time, new roofs, windows, appliances, etc. And any specific questions to the different points, I'm asking Ramona Heisen, the president of Nelson & Associates, to address those.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. You're more than welcome to come sit here in the front and make it easier. So, any questions from the committee? Senator Boyd, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here. And Mr. Senator, thank you for your report. If I understood you correctly, I'm just trying to get in my mind a time frame that maybe we could expect. So, sir, I think you said in August of 2019 you recognized there was a problem and then hired the firm to work you out of that problem right around that same time or subsequent to that date? And I'll tell you why I'm asking. The reason I'm asking, the audit was done in October of 2021, correct? So that's 2 years. I'm just trying to get an idea of when results will, I mean, where the results are perhaps and when you anticipate, you know, the results to start occurring if they haven't already, if that's a fair question.
Chair, you're recognized, Chair Weeks.
In August of 2019, we were notified that there was an issue and we hired the management company January the 1st, 2020. There was 3 months where we went through the process of deciding which direction we were going to head into and how best to answer the questions with the new management company coming on board. And the audit didn't begin, and it ended in October of 21. It began about October of 20.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Escamana, you're recognized.
Thank you so much. So obviously, improvements to the property will require tenants to not be in the unit. And I'm also curious how many tenants just had to relocate completely because the living conditions were so squalor. Maybe just kind of speaking to the operations of how that has been managed. How many tenants still call this area home and how many left? Maybe just some more of those stats would be helpful.
Ms. Heisen, you're recognized to answer the question. And for the record, if you can just introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Ramona Heisen. I'm the president of Nelson & Associates, Inc., and we are the third-party property management company for the Belgrade Housing Authority. So we manage Okeechobee Center and Osceola Center, and there are two USDA RD farm labor housing properties. They have about 712 now. Units, and I'd like to clarify that those are for farm workers, so it could be they go from 0 to 4-bedroom units. They're all single one-stories. So Nelson & Associates manages affordable housing in Ohio, Indiana, and Florida, and we came on board in January of 2020. All of the previous employees were terminated. We interviewed, we did keep some. The executive director resigned, as well as the maintenance supervisor. We did not keep him. But we had a very selective process in who we kept. We also hired additional employees. One thing that we noted that it was very important to, one, have an office at both properties. So we opened up an office at Okeechobee Center because they're about a mile or so apart and they're on opposite sides of the road. So we now have an office at both properties. Another thing that we noticed is that we needed to be able to communicate to all of the residents. Many of the residents are Haitian. They only speak Creole. Since then, we now have 3 office personnel who speak Creole, who can communicate with the residents. We implemented very good preventive maintenance plans, emergency call systems. We have begun to address, we work very closely with the health department as well as USDA. We've had consistent meetings. They inspect our units. We developed a plan to rehab units. So what we actually did, they already had vacancies. And so what we actually did was start to rehab. The Housing Authority did have funds, available funds, that were in reserves. And we began to draw down on those funds in accordance with the plan that we worked out with USDA. So the plan, we have an immediate plan and we have a long-term plan. And in your response, should I continue?
I think, did she answer your
question? Oh, I'm sorry.
Is your question answered, Rep?
It is almost answered. I think you were about to get to with the short-term, immediate, and long-term, so I think that'll help answer. I'm just curious, you know.
You're recognized.
Yeah, so continue.
Okay. Before I get there, I just want to say to answer some of the question is that since this all started, when we came on board in January of 2020, I'm sure that even the representatives in Palm Beach County would tell you that they see considerable improvement. So we've made a great turn. We're on the right track. We have turned things around. So the immediate plan, we have what's called a workout plan with USDA. It's an executed document. In our response to you that I believe you've received a copy of, it kind of speaks to all of this, but our immediate plan, we've already repaved all of the roads in one center. We've begun to put pathways. We're putting on roofs. We've gone in and we've rehabbed many units. We identified the worst units. We transferred the families from the bad units into the new units that included new kitchens, baths, everything totally done in those units. The long-term plan, though, is we've spent probably in this past two years in January, we've spent probably $2.5 million of the reserve monies that the authority had making improvements. The long-term plan with USDA is that a NOSA is supposed to be issued this month, which we will apply for. And we're anticipating possibly about $8 million in rehab funds, as well as restructuring some debt so that we can totally rehab both properties.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Boyle, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe you probably hit this, but I just want to make sure. So with respect to the audit findings, you feel like you've tackled each one of those findings and your progress is such that, you know, you're making improvements on these specific findings? Or I know it's a tough quote, but kind of, are you 75% there? Are you 50% there? Are you 100% there? I mean, in your professional opinion, where are you vis-a-vis the findings that were outlined a little bit earlier?
You're recognized.
Okay. I am very pleased. Proud of the progress that we have made. We're right where we said we would be. We're right here, and we're continuing to make improvements, and we're hopeful that the NOSA comes out this month as it's supposed to come out. These two properties are the largest farm labor housing properties in the country under USDARD. They are committed to work with us to address all of these deficiencies and rehab these properties. The board is committed. Palm Beach County has been extremely helpful. We've developed partnerships with the sheriff's office and all of the social service agencies. We've totally turned these properties around.
Thank you. Representative Wilhite, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for allowing me to sit on this very important presentation. Thank you for your work and your presentation here today. It's my understanding that a lot more has been done at the Okeechobee facility, and I'm just wondering where you are at the work and the inspections and the process of going on in Osceola as well. Obviously, you said they're a little distance apart and stuff, but they're still both equally important.
You're recognized.
When we first took over in January of 2020, it was Okeechobee that was the worst property. It was very bad. Osceola, because that's where the main office was, it was better maintained. So we did focus, and that is the property that the health department immediately came to because it was the worst, and it had the worst problems. So we did start there, and because we did do all of the roads, it looks 100% better. We did exterior painting, but we did it at both properties. We're rehabbing units. We're doing that at both properties. But it now, I can see where anyone looking at them both now would go, oh, Okeechobee looks better now than Osceola. And it is because we concentrated on Okeechobee, but we will be doing the same at both properties, and we are. But we need to do the roads at Osceola, and we are looking for to include that in the work that we do when we apply for the NOSA and award it the funds.
Thank you. Just one follow-up.
Yeah, you're recognized for a follow-up.
And thank you. And I appreciate you working on that, because obviously there we have seen that there's been a lot of problems in the living conditions at them. And obviously aesthetics is very important in roads. I just want to put on the record, obviously, that the living conditions, obviously what people are living in and making sure that they're safe and healthy and protected inside of the residence is obviously the most paramount thing. And so I guess maybe if you could just give the committee or something later, even a follow-up, a time frame for where you think that you'll get to making both of those facilities equally safe and livable and protected. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. I'd like to recognize Vice Chair Baxley for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question that I have relates to other relationships, because I'm sure that affects your stability overall. Specifically looking at the fact that the authority, as I'm informed, signed a settlement agreement with the Department of Health. And as part of the agreement, the authority agreed to invest no less than $500,000 in the properties in the next 12 months. I want to know if you've complied with that agreement, or have you been fined by the Department of Health, who could fine you $500 a day?
You're recognized.
You are correct in that we have a settlement agreement with the Health Department. That agreement was extended for an additional year, and it was extended within the last 2 months. But the health, we're working very closely with the health department. So every time we turn a unit, they come out, they inspect it. They just inspected last month probably about 30, 40 units. And so we are in compliance with the health department, and we have until next year about this time, which we anticipate that we'll be well on our way with total rehab.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Have you been fined by the Department of Health on any of that?
In the settlement, the initial settlement agreement, there was a payment that we agreed to make, and if I'm not mistaken, it was $9,000. It was $9,000, and we did pay that when we entered into the initial settlement agreement, which would have been last year. But it was renewed probably last month, and there was nothing that we had to pay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Torres, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, I mean, 1947, this complex is 74 years old. Am I right?
You're recognized.
If I'm not mistaken, the oldest buildings are 68. Now, there is some history.
Okay, yeah. Give or take a few years.
Okay.
May I follow up?
Yeah, you're recognized for a follow-up.
So. What I'm getting at is asbestos, other issues with electricity. Did you find that you're probably better off building a new building and you know, getting these residents into a new structure, or?
You are recognized.
What we find is that this is their home. They are farm workers. They love it there. This is their home. These buildings, we feel, are stable, that with some love, some care, roofs, windows, new kitchens, roads, they're fine. We don't see the need to tear the property down and, you know, have all of these people have to find new places to stay for any period of time.
Well, May I follow
up? Senator Torres, your records for follow-up.
I'm not saying move them out. I'm just saying to, on the property, if you have the acreage to have a new structure go up on the, you know, so the people can move out of those old structures and something new. I mean, I understand people, they're satisfied with it and the low wages and who work there, who live there every day. But I'm just saying that when you repair and you renovate, you're going to find more issues in an old complex. Is it worthwhile? That's what I'm getting at.
You're recognized if you're able to answer the question.
Okay. What we've done, we're purposely keeping at least 50 to 60 vacancies. And we actually refurbish a vacant unit. And we move people in to that unit. And that's how we will address it when we do the rehab. We will have about 50 to 60 vacancies, and we will totally rehab those units, and then we will move people around.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Representative Davis, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I'm looking through the report that you all submitted, and not necessarily going down the lines where Senator Torres was going, but when you're talking about unsatisfactory living conditions, mm-hmm. I had a few questions shared. Is that okay? Two.
Yeah, yes, you're recognized for two questions without going through the chair.
The question of how many residents are still in the, 714 units, mm-hmm. has never specifically been answered. So that's my first question. And then the next question is, when you're dealing with the satisfactory living conditions, and I'm reading in the report that you had vermin infestation, mold-like substances. How are you all actually dealing with this when you're not moving people out of the homes? Unfortunately, we've had apartment complexes like this in Jacksonville, and we're still dealing with this, not really knowing where to move people, how to move people, and how to solve a vermin infestation that has continued for years. So that's not really shutting one building down and trying to fix the other one when you have infestations like that. So I'm really curious.
You are recognized to answer those two questions.
Initially, the things that we did is address, one, proper disposal of their garbage. They didn't even have trash cans to properly dispose of their garbage. So we got the large containers. Every unit has a large container. They did not have professional exterminating services. We have professional exterminating services going in every month and treating each unit. If anyone has specific problems, then they are called back. We have professional landscapers now, so the grounds are very clean. There isn't garbage. We've dealt with the infestation. We definitely we're working with the residents so that now that we can communicate with them, that they too understand certain things that they need to do to assist us in maintaining the units. So we have identified the worst units. And we have moved those people out of those units. We've implemented routine maintenance services. So now people know if something is wrong, if you have a leak or if anything is wrong, call it in. And we will send our people out. We're doing inspections. Our maintenance people are in the units now. And so we see what's going on. And even though you may not be transferred, your work orders are being addressed in your unit. So every unit is not real bad like that. We've transferred the tenants that were in the units that definitely needed to be transferred.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Representative Escamana, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you so much, Chair. And actually, it's going to be maybe more of a question to you as the chair, too. I'm just listening to Representative Tracy Davis. It's clear that we all find found these standards to be horrifyingly bad, and that's why there was an audit, that's why there's change. But the reality is that there are tenants across Florida, whether it's a public entity like a housing authority or just a private provider, who have similar experiences. And code enforcement is not a very strong option for many families in different cities. This depends on how well-staffed they are and what those codes are. And so I guess a question for you is, you know, would there be a space for us to offer in a future setting recommendations for policy change for tenants to always have a way to seek justice or seek changes? Because we have apartments in West Orlando that are sometimes affordable housing units, sometimes not, but the living quality is substandard and their options to seek any type of rectification is very limited. So we'd love to hear any feedback to what we could do as a body to try to tackle the larger issue at hand.
Well, thank you, Representative. As required by law, the Auditor General will complete a follow-up audit when it comes to the Housing Authority and perform a follow-up audit to determine any progress that we have identified. In addition to your other question, I think it would be an important conversation to further have internally and see what can be done. So I appreciate the feedback. Any other questions? Okay, I see no other questions. I just want to personally thank each one of you for coming in today and presenting in front of the Joint Legislative Auditing Committee. So thank you.
Thank you.
That's right. We do have an appearance card for public testimony. Is Ed Chase from Palm Beach County. Mr. Chase, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On behalf of the Palm Beach County Commission, and particularly on behalf of Commissioner Melissa McKinley, who represents the Belleglade area on the Palm Beach County Commission, I wanted to thank the committee for its very thoughtful and very thorough audit. It was Commissioner McKinley who first sounded the alarm about living conditions at the Housing Authority back in June of 2019. By July 30th of 2019, at her request, we had executives from the USDA Rural Development Agency's Gainesville office and Washington, D.C. office visiting on site to see the conditions themselves. And it was in October that she and Commissioner Mac Bernard asked the Palm Beach County Legislative Delegation to make the audit request. So I'm here to thank the chair and particularly the staff for a very thorough audit and very sound findings and recommendations, all with which we agree. I also want to recognize the Belleglade Housing Authority for their thoughtful responses to the audit, budgeted improvements and changes to date. We are hopeful, and we look forward to continued improvements at the Belleglade Housing Authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, as required by law, the Auditor General will schedule a return to the Housing Authority and perform a follow-up audit to determine its progress in correcting the audit findings. Is there any other business before the committee? Senator Torres moves we adjourn. Is there any objection? Seeing none, show the motion adopted. We are adjourned.